Welcome to the Friday Fix, where we give you news and interviews from the world of Singlerism. That extra hit to string you out until Sunday story. And now here's your host, Empty Set Entertainment's director of doom, a real girl herself, A. Kovacs.
Hey, junkies, this is A Real Girl. I'm here for this week's Friday Fix, as ever, with Mr. Scott Sigler. Hello, how are you?
I am fantastic. How are you?
I'm good.
Good.
I'm good. Last week, we had a little bit of a slow day. We did a recording of a rambly discussion about the dogs in costume.
Yes.
But this week, we're coming back with much more hard-hitting, relevant to our interests.
Correct. So we're done with the cancer of society, which is dressing dogs in costumes.
Of all the things that are wrong in the world, I'm going to say making Reese dress like Princess Leia,
you know,
or
what?
Football,
every time
or
you
a
dress
rooster,
a
or
dog
a taco.
Up, when you dress a dog up, ISIS wins.
That's not true.
It's totally true.
That's not
Why
true.
Why do you think they're still rolling down there?
Because I don't think that's true. What if that entire army is nothing but dogs in costume?
Oh, man. That'd be a good story. Dogs anyway, and people costumes. That's awesome.
We're back this week. We had such a rambly week last week. We normally talk about what we're drinking during the cast. We have all sorts of notices, information about it. We didn't do any of that.
No.
So this week, I'm actually drinking champagne. You're drinking coffee. What's up with that?
I need to wake up a little bit. I've got work to do, and I need to get that done, and that's about it. I got work to do. I got to make cool things for cool people. So need to wake up.
Yeah, we've been pretty busy. So I don't blame you, but I'm also drinking champagne.
Well, la di da.
Well, this week
we got the fanciest podcast in all the land.
Not
the champagne
anymore.
Came all the way from the East Coast, and it's fantastic.
Not anymore. Not fanciest anymore.
So, all right, what are we talking about today?
We have had a handful of casts where we talk about our favorite movies or favorite songs or whatnot. Mm-hmm. This week, we're going to talk about our top five books.
Books, excellent.
Yeah.
I am ready for
this. And
this
is such a big, heavy topic for us because, you know, the whole writer thing.
So, it is our business.
It is. So I'm going to make a caveat and say two caveats. One, no Scott Sigler books in the mix.
Okay.
And two, these are... You know, I only gave you maybe 15 minutes before we started recording decide on this, so...
I might have missed some.
So this is not a comprehensive, these are the five books you think people need to read before they die. These are...
Five bitchin' books. Can we tell them what book we're going to give away?
Yeah, please do.
In this podcast, we're giving away The Name of the Devil by Andrew Main, our buddy. It is a Jessica Blackwood novel, so it's kind of investigative thriller crazy stuff. Mm-hmm. It's book two in the series. It's a sequel to Angel Killer, and Andrew Main is a fantastic magician.
Yeah, he's a great human being. He's a fantastic magician. He's creative and inventive in all of his storytelling,
yes,
on his TV shows and writing and magic and everything.
If you guys want to see cool clips, go to YouTube, search for Andrew Main, M-A-Y-N-E, and see his magic. And people tell us their favorite five books in the comments at scottsigler.com for this episode of the Friday Fix, guess what? They can win this. We'll send it to them. It's been soiled by me. I read it already, too.
I really liked this book.
Okay. Cool.
So I think it's a fast read. I think it's one of those things that people say, like, hey, this is a great beach read, but it's October, and I don't really know what a beach read means, but...
It's a book you read on the beach.
Right. But you can read any book. You can read Jane Austen on the beach, and
I don't
fine.
Think that's legal.
Oh, I see. But anyway, this is what I would consider like sort of fun, fast, entertaining, creative thriller. So I think it would be fun.
Very cool. Well, we got to see your top fives, and now we're going to talk about our top fives.
Yeah. So we are going to start with you and your number five.
Ooh, I didn't put them in order. I got to think now. Number five, I will go with... Misery by Stephen King. My all-time favorite book. And most of these books I either completely obsessed over, or they were pivotal in my career and wound up changing how I do what I do.
Sure. And are there any clarifications while we're talking? Are these all of yours fiction books? I think they're not. I think mine are all fiction books too.
Mine happen to be all fiction books. If I had to go through and list my top five nonfiction books, I don't even know if I could think of them. I'm not a very educated reader person.
No, well, I wasn't exactly thinking that, but I was thinking it might be fun to kind of talk about your five top five recommendations for people who want to do what you do, because I know that Misery is quite influential for you as a person who is a writer. Mm-hmm. But I also know, like, I'm reading a book that about screenwriting that you just finished, mm-hmm. And said, like, you also have to read this because this is relevant to our interests.
Correct.
And that's a nonfiction book. And so it might be, both might be worth doing. Maybe we'll do
that. We can do that. I'm sure I could go through sometime and get that figured out. But the reason Misery comes in at number five is that it was a book that showed me how you could play with type on the page to make things more suspenseful.
Sure.
So it's not just the story. What King does is he's got the story, and then he's got a story within the story. Paul, our protagonist, is held captive by Annie, and Annie wants Paul to write a book. So she buys him a typewriter, an old Royal typewriter, and Paul is injured and can't escape the house, held against his will. And so he starts writing the story. And when he writes the story, instead of it being a nice New York font or some kind of serif font, you know, the smooth, like mm-hmm. you don't even realize it's a font, it's just pretty, it's this... Margins come in and it's this jarring Courier font, and Courier font to this day is the font most people write manuscripts in.
Sure.
Back 20 years ago, that if you turn it into anything but Courier, they would just throw it out.
Right.
So it's dominant, and because it looks different on the page, it's jarring. And then he has got what I think is the most brilliant pagination or layout trick ever, which is first the T falls off the typewriter. So he has to go in, and all the T's are scrawled in with pencil. So as you're mm-hmm. reading this book, you're seeing the pages it would look like as Paul would type it. T's are scrawled in with pencil. Then E, then N, which I believe, I don't know if I have this exactly right, but the three most common letters in the English language
break
on the typewriter. So by the end, you are reading about Paul and Annie's story, and then the story within a story is moving along at a rapid pace. And then as the story within a story is going, all this, it's like, you know, 60% scrawled little pencil marks. And it's this real gradual ramp up that you don't notice happening. But at the end, you just feel so unbelievably anxious. And he did that with the way things looked on a page.
I know, it's amazing.
And that was a huge influence if you read Infected. And if you read Infected,
yeah.
It's full of different, it was written 15 years after Misery, maybe. So now there's instant message chats and things like that, but it was a huge influence, and it's also just an absolutely amazing book. And Kathy Bates is God.
Well, Kathy Bates is in the movie. That's why Scott's referencing that. If there happens to be anybody on earth who hasn't heard of or seen Misery. But yeah, I agree that using that artificial yet native to the story, like it's native to the book,
mm-hmm.
it's easy to read. You see it start totally rationally and calmly, like, oh,
right.
This distinguishes the manuscript from the story. I get that. And then as it falls apart and everything gets more chaotic and Annie gets more disassociated and more out of her mind. And and Paul gets more and more desperate to save his own life because he sees what's coming. That starts to fall apart. It's an interesting
thing. I would recommend you're not going to get that experience with an audiobook. You're not going to get that experience with an ebook, probably. That is, if you want to see what that's like, I highly recommend just buy the thing hardcover and get it and read it. And it's a very cool experience. And although King has done an enormous amount of super cool stuff, that's the single coolest thing he's ever did, in my opinion.
Hmm. Well, my number five is different. Is Love in the Time of Cholera by Gabriel Garcia Marquez.
Okay.
I'm
not too familiar.
I
know the name and there was a movie, but I don't, what's it about?
So it's about, so it's magical realism. This is what's important about my list. I'm apparently a big fan of shit that's made up. And specifically magical realism, I think, is in three of my top five. And so it's a story about two people falling in love. They fall in love over something like 40 or maybe 90 years.
40 or 90.
Yeah. You know, they go on a boat ride that lasts somewhere in the vicinity of a dozen years. I don't really know. Magical realism is a genre unto itself. It doesn't make sense in my world, which is fascinating because I don't believe in any superstitions.
You're the most rational, non-superstitious. You mock all of my superstitions about what clothes to wear for Lions games.
Yeah, or whether or not you can watch a game if you happen to miss it when they win. Can you watch it again?
Nope,
and all that
not
stuff.
Till
I don't
they
really
lose.
Understand
not till
that.
You can't, if you're not watching and they win, you can't watch again until they lose.
Yeah,
that's the rules.
Yeah.
Because that's your fault.
That's not your fault.
But see,
fault.
That is a real world, believing in magic, a realistic magic that sort of has some level of associative reality, if you will. And then you read your favorite books are magical realism.
And maybe it's because they're very clearly fiction, right? I mean, I don't believe that you wearing Lions imprinted socks are actually helping your team win or lose.
Socks are 1-0.
Oh, Lord. Which means you're going to wear socks every single day.
I didn't even wash them. I kept last week's outfit. I didn't even wash anything.
Okay. Here's between you and me. Nobody else is listening.
Okay.
I just have a secret between men and women. I know that you're a man, I'm a woman.
Yeah.
Here's a hint.
Okay.
Never, ever tell another female.
I think I just told 20,000 humans.
Nobody had to hear that. Nobody had to hear that. Never, never tell another female, oh, I didn't even wash them and wear them every week.
I'm not washing them. And they lose, I'll wash them. That's the way it works. I know you just told me not to tell you that, but you got to understand the rules.
Dude.
So tell me more. Love and Time of Cholera.
Gabriel Garcia Marquez, he won a Nobel Prize for Literature. He's hugely famous.
Did he win for this book?
I think he won for this book or 100 Years of Solitude.
I believe he just passed on too, didn't he? Is that right?
Well, not terribly recently, but yeah, he's okay. He in I think 2008 or 9.
Oh, okay. Well, that's, so, I thought it was more recent. All
it
right,
might have
cool.
been. It might have been more cool. recent. But and he also read some nonfiction that I also like. But that was the first time I read a book where things went off the rails in a well. Clearly, this is not really happening mm-hmm. way, mm-hmm. and I didn't care. And I'm not talking about, you know, obviously if it's sci-fi, it's sci-fi, but this is different, right? It looks and feels and smells like something that probably happened. Mm-hmm. And then it goes off into a, you know, a mm-hmm. 12-year boat ride or something like that, where they can't get off the boat because people have cholera or whatever, but it's romantic and beautiful and whatever. And I wasn't used to that. I wasn't used to, magical things happening right in the middle of your normal workaday life.
Right, and that's the secret sauce. That's what magical realism is like. Our world, people like us, but there is magic afoot. So it's not like urban fantasy. There's no street orcs or street elves or anything like
right.
that, right?
Right, right. It's not magic, and it's not urban fantasy, and it's not fantasy, mm-hmm. because it's not... Like, I'm such a huge fan of Mike Coles. He writes military fantasy, I guess?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. That's people using magic, like full-on using terramancy or necromancy right, or right. something like that. This mm-hmm. is not that. They the characters themselves are not magical in their own reality.
Okay.
Their reality is magical in a different way than mine is.
Got it.
Or magical and mine is not, however you want to put that. But anyway, I love it, and it's one of those weird things. Every time I tell one of the nieces or nephews, like... Right, you should read this book, mm-hmm. and it's either this one or some of the other ones that are also on my list that are also magical realism. They're like, oh, this was on my reading list for the summer, but I ignored it. Mm-hmm. And all three of my nephews and my niece read one of these three books that I'll talk about okay. that are magical realism and loved them.
Well, there you go. My number four, and it gets hard to define what comes first, but I will go with number four. I will go with Relic. By Douglas Preston and Lincoln Child.
Nice.
And there's another book on this list that is there for the same reason, which is when I was a younger writer and emulating Stephen King and emulating Dean Koontz, Clive Barker, all the great horror guys, and not really succeeding at it because there was way too much frickin' magic going on. So, which is interesting because basically Stephen King is kind of magical realism in a horror way. It's regular people like us and then outlandish things happen and that's how people deal with it.
Right. And well, and especially the Dark Tower series, at least the first three mm-hmm. are absolutely, you're right, that magical realism in a horror setting.
Magical realism in a horror setting. So I had a lot of trouble writing that because while Stephen King is a craftsman and Dean Koontz is a craftsman in the skill in creating a character that you want to follow, when the random crazy bug nut stuff would happen, I'd be like, oh, come on, really? This, not, the wall grew tentacles? What's that? A can of peanut brittle? What are you doing to me, Stephen King?
So like Roland opening the door and being on an airplane doesn't work for you.
No, that was more okay because it was an imaginary world and maybe he did a better job of setting it up. But for okay. example, in Needful Things, the climax of Needful Things, which I won't spoil if people haven't read it, but it involves
right,
a can of peanut
really
brittle.
Rough. Yeah,
it's really rough. And it's obvious at that point he ran out of time or energy or had a deadline or he thought that was cool or whatever. And it just is so non sequitur with the rest of the book that it makes me go, oh, I wish I hadn't read that book. So the first one I read, Relic, which was straight up monster story. It's a monster running around the Metropolitan Museum in New York, but it's all plausible science. So instead of using magic, they take some liberties with science. They explain how things work, explain how the monster gets to be there. It was a huge hit. They made a wonderfully cheesy movie out of it with Michael Madsen. Mm-hmm. And the monster effects are pretty cool. But the book itself, I was like, so I can write scary stuff like Stephen King and Clive Barker, but use actual science for that. And it was like a delivering moment. I felt so like, oh, great. And then I started writing, like Infected and Earth Core and books like that were like, okay, now I feel validated that I can do this because these guys are doing this and a lot of people like it. So it was a career changer to read that book.
Interesting. So my career is different than yours. So yes. All of my books, so far, both of your books are relevant to your career.
Well, that's why that's
right. Yes. Of course. And I expect maybe all of them are, but that's not true for me.
What's your fourth book?
The Handmaid's Tale. The Handmaid's Margaret Tale Atwood? By Margaret Atwood. Mm-hmm. Because I read it at a time in my life where, so I am a critical thinker. I'm a rationalist. I'm a secularist. I don't believe in anything supernatural. I don't believe in God, those sorts of things. Mm-hmm. And there was a time in my life where I felt that, but didn't know that other people might feel it too. Mm-hmm. And The Handmaid's Tale is a whole story about people who simply want to be who they are. And it was the first time I read something where it was like, it was harsh and it was ugly and it was sort of an analog to, like, I wasn't having harsh and ugly things happen in my life, but I feel differently than all these people feel, and that's okay. Mm-hmm. That was one of the first stark examples of that. It's a dystopian tale of a future where human reproduction has sort of gone off the rails. Yeah. And there's a subjugated class of people who are fertile. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. It's a story, sort of dystopian story about how I guess I don't want to ruin too much about it because it's weird. Where there can't be a price put on something like that, like fertility. And yet the richest class and the ruling class will do that every chance they get.
Sure.
So it was sort of shocking and I hated it when I first read it.
Okay.
It's like nobody would treat people like that. I'm going to get a little bit. Yeah. Right. Right. So then I get a little bit
Nobody
older.
Nobody would treat people like chattel. That's crazy.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, that's just it. And that's why it's on my list, because then you sort of grow up and you think, oh.
Yeah.
Oh. Oh.
That's not even really science fiction at all. That's basically.
Right. I mean, the specifics of it are not yet in practice, but that whole idea that it doesn't matter what I want if somebody else can legislate it and afford it, mm-hmm. it might not matter what I want. That's pivotal, I think, you know, to everybody's living a free life, if they live a free life. And that was the first time I sort of saw that was not necessarily right.
I saw that movie, too.
Yeah, it was an
fun,
interesting movie.
Fun movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was very good.
And the movie has a lot of the, is also a little side note, a little tangent here. That watching the movie was one of the first times I saw set design and costume design as useful pieces for mood and everything else. It's very stylized, and the handmaids were different colors and all that other stuff.
Yeah.
And I never really, that's not in, as far as I can recall, I don't think that's in the book, because I was surprised to see it. And it definitely
sets
the
mood. Oh, it wasn't
in
the book, because it was such a prominent part of the, the color palette was such a big part of the movie.
Yeah, you know, to be fair, it's been a long time. I don't think it is, though. But okay. Now I might have had them amalgamized.
My number three?
Yes, sir.
Is following the same trend as my number four. And that is Jurassic Park.
Oh, what a great book.
Jurassic Park is a very short mm-hmm. book. It's probably 250, 280 pages. Crichton does it. It's a boom, boom. It's just a crazy monster story with mm-hmm. real monsters. Mm-hmm. And although the method he uses for cloning dinosaurs apparently is not ever going to work, you never know that reading the book.
Right.
He sets everything up in a wonderful system. So again, just like with Relic, I got this kick-ass action-adventure monster story, but it was plausible and believable, which for me as a reader lets me dive so much farther down the rabbit hole.
Sure.
You know, if the villain's a crazy ghost that can do anything, I can enjoy that book, but I have a certain disassociation from that book. When when the monsters are actual dinosaurs that have been cloned from frozen or from petrified mosquitoes, apparently that's going to happen.
From the blood and petrified mosquitoes.
Yeah, from the blood and petrified mosquitoes. That's totally going to happen, and I can believe that. But he does such a good job of craftsmanship in making this a realistic feeling story. Mm-hmm. And plus, we all love dinosaurs. So
yeah, you know, I had read The Andromeda Strain. That's the first Crichton book mm-hmm, that I read. Mm-hmm. And it was hard for me. I was young, probably 14, 15 years old or something like that. And,
okay.
And it's, it isn't as cinematic as Jurassic Park is. Mm-hmm. And so I'd read that, and I used to read sci-fi with my stepdad, and then I read after the fact. I was like, yeah, I mean, that was it. Was, I mean, it was good, and it was interesting, but it was a little a lot for me. Mm-hmm. And he was like, yeah, I know, read Jurassic Park. Hmm. Like, yeah, I mean, I read Michael Crichton, and it was all right. And he was like, read Jurassic Park.
Yeah.
And I read Jurassic Park. That's one of the few books that I can remember reading, like, in one sitting.
Okay. Oh, cool.
And couldn't put it down and was up till 3 a.m. and that kind of thing.
And you may not know this, but they made a movie out of that book, too.
I didn't.
Yeah, they did. It's not very well known, but they did make a movie out of Jurassic Park.
With the sublime Jeff Goldblum.
That cast is on point. What is your number three, ma'am?
I think you might be surprised.
Okay.
Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone.
Why would that surprise me?
Well, because, I mean, you know, I'm not necessarily, that seems like, for me, it seems a little, to me, it seems a little frivolous for me.
It's magicalism.
Yeah, I don't think that's a genre, but it changed the world. I mean, I know that sounds a little hyperbolish, mm-hmm. but it changed the world. It created a relationship between my nephews and I that didn't exist because they were young enough that. And I was like, yes, we will go stand out at midnight and pick up that book. Yes, we will do that. Yeah. Yes, you can both be Harry Potter for Halloween. It's okay that there are two of you. Like, right. Things like that. Right. And you know, it's the whole series, but that in particular, that's a boy dealing with magical things that will help him deal with the shitty things in his life mm-hmm. at his age. Mm-hmm. And the whole series, as he grows up, the challenges he faces grow up as well.
Yes.
And I know it's all magic and I know it's all fake and I know it's all fiction, but it was a roadmap.
It clearly touches on some common themes of being an outsider and mm-hmm. feeling like you have no one and then suddenly finding a place where you not only belong, but you're special.
Right.
It appeals to so many things that young readers are going through at that point in their life. And in addition to just being a generally good story.
Right. And it has, you know, Harry is definitely the underdog, which we all feel like until mm-hmm. he's not, has a strong female best friend, yep. which is important, mm-hmm. Who is not prized for anything other than who she is in all those mechanizations. And I love that, too. It's sometimes she's prized because, like, she goes to the ball and she's, I think that might be the next book. But regardless, she goes to the ball. She's dressed up. She's gorgeous. Mm-hmm. And Harry's jealous. Mm-hmm. And he should be. You know, but also she saves the day with her brain when magic won't do too. So I love that too.
Have you ever seen the Saturday Night Live skit where Hermione Granger comes back to school for their second year and apparently she's hit puberty?
I haven't. Who plays Hermione Granger?
The redhead who played in the remake. She was in Mean Girls. The redhead from Mean Girls.
Lindsay Lohan.
Lindsay Lohan plays it, and Lindsay Lohan, and just at the height of her hotness, and when she still had her act together, and plays just an amazing role. And you watch Harry and the other guy try and talk to her. I highly recommend it. So yeah. YouTube search Hermione Granger Saturday Night Live.
And I know that things come and go, and there's always something, but I do think, at least in my life, Harry Potter changed and saved the publishing industry to a certain degree.
Well, it we don't know if something else would have come along or things would have changed, but by all means, Harry Potter and Twilight, mm-hmm. you know, can largely be credited for saving the industry because they have created so many readers. And it's a lock that almost any of these booktubers these days, mm-hmm. they all probably grew up reading the Harry Potter
books. For sure
books.
On Twilight because there's that new Twilight book out and they're all crazy for it. But also, you know, it's funny because it doesn't, I don't think that, I think that if the things that entertain you and the things that you love don't hurt anybody else in the process, I don't care what it is. Mm-hmm. That is, if you've done your work, you've done your homework, you've done all your job, you can be entertained by anything that entertains you as long as you're
not
kicking puppies and as long as you're not hurting anybody else.
Yes.
So you want to love Twilight? I got no problem with that. I personally didn't love Twilight. I got about 50 pages in and couldn't handle it.
I did too. I got 50 pages in, but clearly she's doing something right.
But I bring that up to say, you know, I think Harry Potter changed the industry. I think Twilight certainly followed on that, if not, you know, was its own second wave or whatever. I mm-hmm. also think Oprah, who, while she's
That's
a media mogul,
yeah.
has done a ton of things. I kept on and kept on and kept on with all of her damn book group, book club books. After a while, I was like, look, I cannot handle another weak woman who gets strong and then some dude saves her in the end. Are you fucking kidding me, White Oleander? Are you fucking kidding me, Wally Lamb? I'm like, I'm done. I'm out.
You're out.
I'm out.
Right.
That said, I'm super glad she was there.
Yeah, she got books as a conversational point for a lot of people who had either lost their way in reading or had never gotten into reading in the first place. So right. Oprah's a pimp. Yeah. Oprah's great.
Well, I wouldn't have put it that way, but okay.
Okay. My number four. No, my number two. My number two is Anne McCaffrey's Dragonflight.
Those are
my Harry Potters in junior high and high school. I read all them books. I read the Dragonflight series, the Dragon Singer series, and all the short stories I get my hands on. And she was an early influence as far as I want to be like this woman. I want to do this thing and make this amazing, amazing world. Completely from scratch, and then the later books in the series, which establish how things came to be, where she shifts from kind of hard fantasy to full on science fiction and ties everything together, those were huge influencers in the Siglerverse. So now, Anne McCaffrey's line of Dragonflight books and all the associated sequels, etc., all tie into a very specific timeline where everything interlinks, and that was a huge influence. Not like say the Stephen King. Where everything supposedly connects, but they can use magic and something that's this thing can be another thing. And it's open to interpretation, whether these things actually connect. And Anne McCaffrey's was a hardcore linear progression of science fiction novels. So it's a large influence on The Rookie, the GFL series.
That's interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I read those books too. I love them. I'm sure you know. I'm not sure I've ever told this on a cast or not, but in the seventh grade, Anne McCaffrey came to talk to at a library near my house.
Yeah, you did tell me about that. I'm very jealous.
Yeah, and I wanted to go so badly, and my mom was like, okay, have you read any of her books? I'm like, I've read Dragonflight. She's like, can you read any others? I'm like, yes, I can. And so, of course, my mom correctly used that as a motivator. Mm-hmm. So I read a bunch of more books in the 2 months that I had to wait, and my mom took me on a school night out to see Anne McCaffrey, and she was, I have no idea how old she was, but she was, forgive me for saying this, but she was, to my seventh grade mind, she was old lady old. So that could have been 50, she could have been 70.
Right.
I'm sure I can figure out how old she was, but I didn't know at the time. Mm-hmm. But I had known because there was a picture of her in the paper that she was an old lady and I was a seventh grader. And then I showed up at the reading at the library and she had purple, pink, and teal colored hair. Mm-hmm. Her hair was white and she had dyed, and this is 1990-something, so it's a long time ago. She had dyed purple stripes, pink stripes, and teal-colored stripes into her hair.
Uh-huh.
And I couldn't even get over the fact that somebody old could be that cool.
Right.
I'm so grateful, though, because I'm 44 now. Mm-hmm. And I, to that seventh grader me, I'd be old.
Oh, and, yes.
I mean, really old. And that was the first time I had realized that adults can be cool and human just like me, because of course, you know, they're all authoritarian figures when you're in the seventh grade, kind of.
Right.
So not that has to do with her writing, but that was a pretty cool moment.
Well,
in my life.
I'm very jealous, and yeah. I'm very jealous. What is your number two, ma'am?
So number two and number one, I see as spiritual bookends to each other, even though they are not.
I'm listening.
Number two, and I just picked novels. I have a whole bunch of like other things that I would have put on the list, but I was trying to keep it to fiction novels. But number two and number one, number two is Forever by Pete Hamill.
Mm-hmm.
Pete Hamill is a writer who grew up in New York. He lives in New York. He writes in New York. He writes fiction and nonfiction. They're pretty much all about New York. And Forever specifically is another magical realism tale. It takes place in New York. I think it starts in maybe the 1840s and it goes through modern day. And it's a, the basic premise is there's a man who lives on Manhattan Island who, for reasons that unfold in very early in the book, is immortal as long as he never leaves the island of Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
And you would think, like, if there's, well, maybe you wouldn't think, but I grew up in New York, right? So part of me thinks, like, if there's any place on earth I would like to be stranded for eternity.
That's a good place.
That's a good place.
Right.
But there's a lot of grace in that book that sort of says, well, you know, one of the things that the reasons that our life is precious is because it's precious and it's short.
Mm-hmm.
And even if it's long, even if it's 100 years long, it's still
short. It's pretty short.
And, you know, you've been probably asked that if you would live forever. And I think I wouldn't.
Oh, I would.
I know you would.
Especially if I got to carry a sword like Highlander, for sure. Yeah.
And if you were going to live forever, you could fucking do anything you want. You could carry a sword if you wanted.
But if you're going to live forever, it might as well be where there's all different kinds of food in New York. Lots of stuff to eat.
So it's a story that takes place. And Pete Hamill, I've read all of Pete Hamill's books, his nonfiction books, his fiction books, all of them. And I am quite a big fan. I am also a New Yorker, a native New Yorker. So I don't know if that matters because his books are bestsellers. So I don't think it matters. But this particular book moved me quite a lot. And I can remember reading, I read the hardcover. Mm-hmm. And I was working at the time in pharmaceutical development. And I was in Hong Kong. And I was in Hong Kong for almost 2 months maybe. And I was doing meetings where I would have the same meeting that would take a whole week, like a Monday through Friday week. And I would do it for different languages, right? Mm-hmm. So I would have that meeting. So I was there forever, which is, I didn't mean to.
I see where you're going with this.
But I was there for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. But like people who spoke Korean would come 1 week and then the next week people, so that we could have translators translating and whatever. And I brought it with me when I left home. And I remember reading to, I knew I had about 30 pages left because I was reading the physical book and it's huge. And I put it down and I wouldn't touch it because I didn't want it to
end. Didn't want it to end.
That's the first one.
That's very cool.
It's the first time that that's ever happened. And I would come home every day and I was staying at the Peninsula Hotel in Hong Kong, which is super fancy.
Okay.
And they would bring you a new fruit every day, a new fruit that you may not have tried from somewhere in Asia, I guess. So I tried dragon fruit and I tried durian and I tried all this stuff that I hadn't tried before. Mm-hmm. And they would, when they cleaned your room or something, they would leave it on the coffee table.
Okay.
And after about, I don't know, maybe 2 weeks, instead of the newspaper, they would keep putting that book on the coffee table with the tray with the fruit on it. And I was like, okay, I'm not reading it. And then I got super paranoid. Like,
why were they moving your book?
I think because it was on my nightstand and they were putting something there so I could relax and enjoy, right?
Okay.
But I was purposefully not reading the last 30 pages, and then it kept showing up on my coffee table.
And you had to get it done.
My coffee table. I finally read it, and I'm still sad it's over. Okay? You know, 20 years later, I'm still sad it's over.
Yeah, that is a bummer.
What's your number one?
My number one book is the gristly chiseled Jack London, the prototypical American male at the turn of the century. And his book Seawolf. Now I could have picked Call of the Wild or White Fang, which I probably read 30 times each. Mm-hmm. I mean, I just read them over and over and over again. Seawolf was an instrumental book, not for writing, but for my life in general.
Tell me more.
Because when I had been, I can't remember how old I was, maybe 12, 10, 10 or 12, somewhere in that ballpark. Our parents were churchgoers and we went to different churches in Sheboygan.
Wait a minute, your parents were churchgoers?
Yes. We went to Lutheran church and went to like a Catholic church once and stuff like that.
Not to derail the conversation, but isn't your mother Jewish and your father Catholic?
They are. That's
fantastic.
That's why we went to Lutheran and Methodist and stuff like that.
Interesting. But as a family?
Yeah, as a family.
Interesting.
It's the only time they could get the boys dressed up, I think, and get them to stop fighting for more than 5 minutes. So, you know, they're young parents. They want to show off their kids. So we would go to church in my... I read the Bible cover to cover, and
that's an experience. That's an unfortunate experience.
I had already identified a few plot holes.
Just a few.
And I'm like, I might be 10. I'm not sure this makes entire sense right here. Maybe when I get older, I'll figure it out. Then I read Seawolf, and there is a pivotal scene in Seawolf where Captain Wolf is the main character, but not the protagonist. The protagonist, who I can't remember his name, gets choked by the captain, by Seawolf. And our protagonist winds up on the boat by accident, and he falls off a ship in San Francisco Bay as the ship is going out to do whaling. And he's like, Rich, like, take me back. And they're like, nope, you're coming with us because we can't go back.
We
can't afford to go back. There's no time to go back. And we watch this guy go from a posh dandy who's never had to work a day in his life, never been threatened, is ultimately privileged in every possible way, have to work his way up from the lowest ranks on this ship in order to become a valued member of the crew. And there's a moment where, and he's very religious and he's preaching to people on the boat. And then Captain Wolf grabs him by the throat at one point and is like, and he's this super powered alpha man, you know, he's an Uberman. And he starts choking our protagonist. And protagonist, of course, is clawing at his arm and fighting. And Captain Wolf's like, what are you doing? If you know where you're going, why are you fighting? Why is your body fighting me? I can send you to straight to heaven, which is exactly where you want to go. And it was just, and it's so well written. And it was a very pivotal moment for me that wound up changing the course of my life, because that basic premise of logic, which is, yeah, when people who are very religious and firm believers get into a life-threatening situation, why do they pray to be saved? And like, why are you praying?
Well, why do they fight for their lives?
Why do they fight for their lives? Like, Jesus, save me. Like, no, your goal is to go be with Jesus. Like, that's why you do all of the things that you do. And now here's your chance and you're on the goods. It's not like, you, and why would you fight for that? And that's a much bigger philosophical issue that I'm sure religious people could debate better than I'm presenting here. But to a 10-year-old kid, it was a lightning bolt. It was like, holy shit, this makes a ton of sense. So that wound up, changing my life. I haven't read the Bible since. Just little bits.
Oh, my goodness.
Little bits.
So I read the Bible at 17 and then again at 27 because I thought that would be, because at 27 I was apparently fucking precious and I thought it would be sort of kismet to read it a decade later once I have lived.
Yes.
It's, for me, it was kind of an interesting thing to realize how practically it just doesn't, practically, it doesn't work for anybody implementing what I understand that they're allegorical, like people who take that to heart, they're allegorical stories that provide guidance and information. And I understand that, but I'm sad because I think that taking that information and then having that just guide you, all the work of how to live a good moral life, that comes from the person, not from the goddamn book. Because the book is not at all moral in a thousand ways, but how a bright, good human wants to live a bright, good life, and they interpret that and trust it and love it, I think it's unfortunate because I think it takes away the work they've done for themselves.
I will say one more thing, and we'll close out with your number one, which is Seawolf is a spectacular book, but the ending goes completely off the rails. It's one of the worst endings ever to a book. So if you're reading it, don't think you're going to get blown away at the end. The end is very much a letdown, but the whole process of this guy for becoming a grown-up, a working-class grown-up, is magical.
Yeah.
What is your number one book, ma'am?
My number one, you already know this I tried to make you read it.
I read part of it. Yeah. I did, yeah.
No, and I want to talk about why we stopped reading it, because it's a perfect, I don't understand this, but I love it. And that's, that's what entertainment is.
Yep.
It's a book called Winter's Tale by Mark Halperin.
Terrible movie.
Terrible movie. Here's my caveat. Dudes, I literally read this book 22, 23, 24 times, like a lot of times.
Okay.
I went to see the movie. What were we doing? I think we were
I went with you.
Yeah. So we were recording like the All Pro or the Champion, something like that. And I said like, oh, it comes out tonight. I really want to see it, but we have to work early tomorrow. And you were like, no, are you kidding? It's your favorite book. Yeah. Are you kidding? We're going. Mm-hmm. And I had, you were still living in San Francisco and I was up. So like I went home from the office and I put away on my computer and stuff. And then we went to the movie and it was, It is the biggest travesty, and for me personally, the biggest travesty I have ever seen from book to movie ever. Yeah, I think Ang Lee, somebody famous, or Akiva Goldsman wrote the script. Mm-hmm. It's such a it has nothing to do with anything with the book. That's all I'll say. So if you are thinking like, hey, maybe these books, I'll try to read them. Or if there's a movie, I'll do the shorthand and I'll watch it. Fucking watch Misery.
Yeah.
That's a pretty good representation of the book. Do that. No problem.
Winter's Tale.
Watch The Handmaid's Tale.
Yeah, Handmaid's Tale.
Absolutely, no Winter's matter Tale what you do, never watch the movie for Winter's Tale.
It was a train wreck of a movie before Amy Schumer even had a career. That's what we're talking about here.
Yes.
A train wreck.
Dude, there's one point. Okay, so I'll talk about the book in a minute, but I'll say this about the movie. There was one point I felt so bad because you're perpetually tired, right? You work 10 hours a day.
Yeah.
You got a million things going on in your life. You, at that particular time, there were 1,000 things going on in your life. I think you were getting ready to move, and of course, the Evil Queen is not as healthy as she could be and all that other stuff. And you're like, nope, it's your favorite book. You should go see the movie on an opening.
Yeah, and I wanted to go so I could watch you enjoy that. I was like, this will be sweet.
So there's a part in the book, and the book is huge, and it's magical realism, so it takes, it's over decades and decades, and that, of course, they can't do in a movie, so I get that they make cuts. But there's a part in the book where there's a very, very chubby, very, very young white boy. And in the book, he's described as so chubby that he sort of looks Chinese because his eyes are so, his face is so chubby, his eyes are a little bit almond-shaped and squished together because he's so his cheeks are so chubby.
Okay.
So he embraces that when he meets a man of Asian descent and he wants to emulate him. He embraces that and he starts to wear a little sort of silk cap and all this other stuff. It's this huge part of the book. Mm-hmm. And he idolizes this moot fowl who's all this. So that guy's name is Cecil Mature. He's 10 years old. In the MFing goddamn movie, the only reference to that entire thing, the whole hero worship, all that, is there's a character named Cecil Mature who is a black stable hand who has one line, which is one word, which is yes.
I really had to truncate that down.
I'm so offended.
Tell us, if you can, tell us what this book is about. Because we got to tighten up. We're running long. What's this book about?
It's about a man called Peter Lake. He lives he's a criminal in New York City at the turn of the 18th to 19th century, I think. And it's a love story. He falls in love with a woman who transcends time and space, and he falls in love with the city of New York, which, of course, transcends time and space. Like I said, it's a bookend to my number two. I think they're both worth reading if you are either a fan of New York City, a fan of magical realism, or a fan of...
Or you do a lot of meth. I mean acid. You do a lot of acid.
Okay, let's go with that. But I think I think I read that book as... a native New Yorker at 17, I think, maybe. Yeah. And surely that influences me. But I do think it's beautiful and broad strokes and epic. And, you know, if it's a cold night, it's about winter in New York City.
And I read the first third of it, I believe.
Right.
And was surprised to be caught up. I'm like, this is really something else. It was amazing. Even though I wasn't entirely sure, like, okay, now this magic thing happens, which is usually an anathema to me. Like, you're done. I'm like, if I get to the point where all of a sudden magic stuff is happening that was not properly set up, and now magic happens. We didn't know it was a magic book going in. I'm out. I'm like, life's too short to read books that are dumb. But this book, I got through all the magic stuff, and it was more like, it was a lot like that experience of reading The Dark Tower for the first time, when Roland Deschain is in a drugstore, and people are coming up on him, and we've established that he's a great gunslinger, hence the name of the series. And he turns and fires from the hip, and a guy's coming at him with a straight razor, and he shoots the straight razor in half. And I remember standing up going, what?
Yes.
Holy cow. Like, it's a friggin' book. King can do anything he wants. But I was so immersed in the reality of it that moment was like super heroic moment to establish what a great shot this guy was. Same thing happened with Winter's Tale.
Yeah.
There were parts of Winter's Tale where Peter Lake does something. And I'm like, are you shitting me with this? Like, totally forgetting it's a book.
Well, I remember the first time that I was waiting because we were checking in with each other because you were reading it at my request sort of for me. Mm-hmm. So I remember the first time, it's a small spoiler to say that Peter Lake has a sort of a kindred spirit who's a horse. Mm-hmm. He's a physical horse. He's a real horse. But when he first meets the horse on the streets of Brooklyn, I thought for sure that when that happened, you'd be like, right, dude, I am so glad we're in business together, but fuck you. I'm not reading this book anymore because he's not Wilbur. Like, he doesn't talk or anything, but they are partners. They are well met, and they are meant to be together, and they can understand each other and their needs and whatever. And I thought for sure you'd walk right away. And we flew past that. Like, it didn't matter to you at all. And I was like, all right, well, that's weird.
And then we got to, So I read the first third of the book and loved it. And then this is where literary fiction gets a little precious to me. All of a sudden, I'm a third of the way through the book, and he starts a whole different story with different characters and a different part of New York. And I was just like, man, I was totally invested in the first set of characters. I don't give a crap about these
people.
And then
they don't show up for another 100 pages.
So I've never finished the book.
That's okay. That doesn't matter. So anyway, I think that we're done. We're running a tiny bit long. I will say that these were all novels. I have recommendations if anybody cares for them. My runners up for sure would have been Alice Munro, who writes short stories only. I would say Dear Life is a great book. If you want to read that, I would also say Flannery O'Connor is one of my favorite writers, but she also only wrote short stories. And she writes short stories about horrible people in horrible situations. So I think that they're fantastic. She's also, interestingly, she was a hugely Catholic person, and all of her stories are very hugely Catholic dominated.
Okay.
I still love them. I would read Everything That Rises Must Converge. Do you have any other recommendations?
No.
I guess you said other, not Seawolf, but...
White Fang.
White Fang, for
Call
sure.
The
Call
Wild.
The Wild, for sure.
Those are pretty good. But no.
John Steinbeck, maybe. East of Eden.
My top five. If you didn't make the top five, go sit on the bench, scrub.
See, but you said last we were doing songs, and you gave like another five. So I came prepared.
Okay. Today, nothing.
Well, thank you for talking to me about your books. I appreciate it. I think anybody who's listening will be glad to have... I think that's a little bit more of the insight into the writer. That not so much for me, obviously.
Yeah. Yes. Well, this was fun.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much. Come back on Sunday and get your fix of whatever we're playing. I think it'd probably be live right now.
We'll see what it is.
Yeah. Thanks, Jackie.
Bye-bye. You have been listening to the Friday Fix. Content in this broadcast is copyright of Empty Set Entertainment. For more information on author Scott Sigler and for free weekly audio fiction, visit scottsigler.com. Theme music is the song City of Angels by The Distillers off the album Sing Sing Death House.